This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 31st, Halloween, the year 2000. I'm in Marcille Lee's office in Bascom Hall, and we're going to continue the interview that we began last time, a week ago. Last week, we got you hired at the university. Paul Ginsberg, you'll be working in the Dean of Students' office. Could you talk a little bit about what your primary responsibilities were? For people listening to this, this is 1975, right?
Right.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about...
It was 1976. I came to Madison in 1975, fall of 1975, and started working at the university in the beginning of 1976, and worked at it was one of the extramural departments in the School of Education with Merle Strong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
that's
I
right.
can't,
yeah.
you know, career, technical, and something else. But the name changed after I left, so I can't tell you what that title was. But I worked there from January to the end of June, and then started in the Dean of Students' office July 1, '76.
What were your job responsibilities in the Dean of Students' office?
Oh my. I'm not sure I can even remember back that far. But in general, that office sort of served in a variety of capacities, certainly as ombudsperson for students here at the university. We had a number of programs that we did assisting the university housing or residence halls mm-hmm. in the orientation and information sharing of students who lived on campus. We also developed some program outreach to students who lived in the area but not specifically on campus, both in private dorms and in apartments. Mm-hmm. And one of the programs that I worked with from the beginning was a basic skills communications program for faculty and staff. And so several of us here in the office, but I had responsibility for the program, conducted these workshops.
Tell me about those. That sounds very interesting.
Well, we were actually trying to help them develop more effective communication styles, to learn how to use the skills of basic listening, and mm-hmm. paraphrasing, mm-hmm. and confrontation, etc. And also how to be more sensitive to the varied backgrounds of individuals and, of course, ethnic diversity mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And so we did these workshops for units around campus upon request. And that included, you know, an academic department or an administrative office or the hospital. In a couple of cases, we sort of did programs for them before they got started mm-hmm. with their own education program in university hospitals. So it was really quite an interesting program to have. And we would vary the staff that we used, utilizing people here in the Dean of Students' office, as well as some people who had gone through the training in units around campus. So it was a volunteer staff.
Well, but I've never heard of that.
No, but one that did quite an outstanding job in most instances. And then we were all involved in student advocacy, mm-hmm. assisting students with the various problems that they had. Both personal and those that they might have with the red tape mm-hmm. of the bureaucracy here at the university. And then I spent a good deal of my time also in counseling mm-hmm. and counseled both students and staff and faculty on occasions.
When I spoke with Roger Howard, it must be a month ago now, he talked about a suicide awareness that was developing on campus about concern about students who were taking their lives. Could you talk for a little bit about that?
Sure. Actually, at that time, this office had developed a crisis line. Mm. And my first contact with people on the staff and others around campus was in volunteering to serve at night on that crisis line. And so obviously we were dealing with people who were in various stages of crises, but also some suicidal behavior as well. And then in our own student body, you know, practically every year you have some people who are engaged in suicidal behaviors mm-hmm. of varying degrees. Mm-hmm. And I perhaps did a bit more in that area because mm-hmm. my dissertation right. had right. been on the suicidal behaviors mm-hmm. of college students. Mm-hmm. So that was an area where, you know, we spent a good deal of our time mm-hmm. based on the needs of students.
You mentioned your colleagues a few times. Who are some of the people that you basically worked with in the Dean of Students' Office at that point in time? Roger Howard would have certainly been right. one.
Roger Howard, he and I did quite a number of things together. As with Paul Ginsberg, the Dean of Students, he would work with me on the communication skills workshops and enjoyed it immensely. Mm-hmm. Roger and I did some team counseling, some work with groups. And at that time, you're asking me to go way back, but Courtney Fetterson was on the staff, Mary Rouse, Jim Churchill, administrative and budgetary kinds mm-hmm. of things, and Steve Safian, mm-hmm. Blair Matthews. Blair Matthews and I sort of hit it off from day one. And he and Cordy perhaps worked more with me in the communication skills mm-hmm. area because Cordy had done it with my predecessor. And Blair had worked some with that program mm-hmm. with Tony, who was in the office before I came. And we worked with people all around this campus on a variety of student issues. I used to give some talks to academics, to staff and academic units about student development, mm-hmm. the kinds of issues that students were dealing with at this stage in their lives and how we might work more effectively with them. So Paul and I often did those together mm-hmm. as well. And?
Oh, you worked with some very familiar names. Mary Rouse, of course, is
yes.
still on campus. Roger yeah. Howard is still working. Steve mm-hmm. Safian retired about a year ago, but I seem to still see him around once in a while mm-hmm. doing various things. So,
that's very true.
It yeah. was sort of the core of the staff for many, many, many mm-hmm. years to come. Mary, of course, becoming dean after
yeah.
Paula.
And they were really highly capable mm-hmm. and outstanding people.
Was it a
so
good
it was a pleasure.
Sense of yeah. teamwork in there?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. It was just a great staff to be a part of, largely because I think of the kind of tone that Paul Ginsberg set for the office, his own personal dedication to working with people, but young people in particular, and then his ability to assemble a team that shared his vision and the mission that he had for this office. And we often became very much involved with students who were experiencing academic difficulties in the various colleges. And so we would work both with the students mm-hmm. and the academic services staff at the school and college level. So it was a good position to really get to know many people mm-hmm. all
yes,
around
right.
the campus.
Right.
Yeah.
Those were long hours, too, weren't they?
Well, yes, they were. Yeah. And Paul and I tended to perhaps work longer than most.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, when you're in that kind of position, you never know, yeah. as is the case for me even now, yeah. what a day will bring yeah. for you. You can walk in with your plans all made out for what you're going to do, but you may not get to do any of that
yeah.
in a
yeah.
day at all.
Both frustrating but exciting at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you want positions with variety, I think these were the type mm-hmm. that you would certainly look forward to, because no day passed that you had to be dealing with a single issue at all. So you just never knew what would walk in the door or what somebody would hand you or pick up a phone and call and say, you know, somebody needs help at this place, and would you do it?
What about Joe Corey? When did he enter the picture?
Well, Joe was certainly in the building and a close friend and colleague of practically everybody on this staff. Mm-hmm. He and Paul had worked in university housing, and so mm-hmm. they had a long professional career together. And Joe was heading up academic services mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. So the two offices would work very closely together regardless. Joe had the more administrative responsibilities for such units as Student Financial Services, the Registrar's Office, mm-hmm. Admission, Career Advising, mm-hmm. and Placement. And so those were units that had an academic function. And he was, as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Academic Services, I believe, at that time.
Was it, yeah.
Services or Affairs, I kind of forget which one of those as we move through the years.
And Jim Churchill, actually, didn't he work for Joe and for Paul
Ginsburg
at one point?
Well, he worked first, I believe, for Paul Ginsburg, because he was on the Dean of Student mm-hmm. staff when I came, and he also was involved in my interviews. And he worked, for about, I think he was here 3 years before going to academic services with Joe Corey. Mm-hmm. And so again, I've had a long, long yeah. working relationship with Jim in two different offices.
And he was the financial mm-hmm. person. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I've talked to him on several occasions. He's a very mm-hmm. interesting person.
He is. We used to call him our budget whiz.
And boy, does every department need one of those.
Absolutely.
Now, you said that you had a chance to, before we get to that, where were you located? Where was the Dean of Students office located at that point?
In this wing where I am right now. Right. Yes, my office was actually next door.
Oh, really?
Yes.
We're on the first floor of Bascom, for those people listening, on the northeast side mm-hmm. of the building. That's interesting. Because they moved around a lot, haven't
yeah.
they?
I think that happens in any administrative building, yeah. but certainly, you know, units have moved around.
Yeah.
The move from this floor to the lower floor mm-hmm. for the Dean of Students office occurred more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it was during the years when David Ward was provost
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to get his staff more mm-hmm. centralized.
Yeah. That would have been in the early 90s, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then one, what? I'm sorry.
And the same was true with John Wiley. Mm-hmm. So we've done some shifting about, but it's always to sort of get the staffs mm-hmm. in various units in closer proximity mm-hmm. to each other.
Makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
You had this job, as you said, where you got to meet lots of people from all different areas of the campus. One of the interests you developed, and we're going to be talking about it for most of the rest of the interview, has to do with merit-based scholarships. When did you start thinking about the whole idea of scholarships on campus and how they were distributed and things like that? How did that enter into your consciousness? Can you remember?
Actually, it was an awareness that came fairly soon, although as an assistant dean of students in the dean of students' office, I did not have responsibility in the minority area. You can hardly be on this campus and be from one of those groups without learning very quickly what's going on mm-hmm. in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe my second year in this office was when Roger took over the administrative responsibilities for the area, and so that gave me even more information. But even prior to Roger's getting into that position, I became aware of the university's struggles both in attracting and retaining mm-hmm. minority students. And as I learned about our track record in both areas, we were not attracting large numbers, but we had also developed a program outreach that was focused primarily on students who were at some academic risk. And yet, at the same time, it seemed to me that we were unrealistically expecting those students to be retained at levels fairly comparable to the larger population. And so it was very distressing for me to be in settings and in meetings when people kept publicizing these just atrocious retention rates, retention and graduation rates for minority students and always comparing them with majority students. When really we were talking in lots of instances about apples and oranges. You know, how can you make your focus of activity students who are generally at some academic risk? Then of course there are others who come who are good, solid students on their own, and also because somebody is recruiting them. And then a few come who are really bright and talented. But our major focus in terms of programming throughout the campus still seemed to be largely at that time for those students who were having greater difficulties. And obviously, any minority student would have had problems on this campus just by virtue of the disparity in numbers and not seeing anybody who looked like them in positions of leadership as well as in the student body. Because in those years it was a very small number of students from these underrepresented populations on campus. And so when I kept hearing this, you know, time and again, the gap between. And I kept thinking, there's something wrong with this. If we aren't reflecting the diversity of talents and abilities and our minority student populations to the same extent that they occur in the majority population, then these comparisons don't make any sense at all. And I just, the more I thought of it, I'd say, why aren't we trying to attract bright and talented students to this university? And I'd get the usual responses, despite the fact that I'd always point out that our peer institutions were doing it. It was that this university had not developed or offered merit scholarships to any students at any significant level over the years. They really didn't need to do this because people knew of the excellence of the university and they would come here regardless. But that was not true for these underrepresented populations.
Because of the fact that they were so under, well, tell me.
Well, because of their life situations in the country, first of all, many of them coming from families that were poorer, where parents had not gone to college, and just living and subsisting would be a struggle for many of them. And going to college had not been within the within their thinking in many instances until some years later. And then because there was some financial aid that was need-based available, because universities after the 60s and the civil rights movement were real, universities like this one, were really reaching out to increase those numbers, then they were coming. But they were ill-prepared, not just academically, as everybody basically assumed, but they were ill-prepared for the culture of the campus that they encountered when they came here. So if you're not attracting diverse talents and abilities in one population that occurs naturally in the other, then why do you keep making those kinds of comparisons? And they were done at every level. The legislature and everybody else, you know, always wanted that kind of information. And the university would set goals. We never met them. And then, of course, we were taken to task publicly. And I'd say rightly so. But we weren't really coming up with any solutions, as I could see. So there was that thinking on my part. And then because I worked late often, I would be in the office after 5 o'clock And every once in a while, a student would appear at the door looking for somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. And Paul and I were often the two who were here. And they'd knock on my door, I'd invite them in, and they'd talk about a whole range of problems. But among those students who came in were some Oneida students who were really very bright and talented, but felt that they had no support here. So they were regularly admissible to the university, so they'd earned their way. There were no special efforts to attract them here. They came because they knew the quality of a degree from this institution. But yet when they got here, they didn't find the support that they needed. And they could see the outreach and the university's programming to assist other students, mm-hmm. but they didn't qualify. They weren't eligible for it because...
Financially we're talking
about. No. Academically.
Okay.
Because they were achieving at higher levels. So yes. Even some of the academic support programs weren't places that they could turn because they weren't earning C's and D's mm-hmm. or failing. Mm-hmm. So they were cut out of that, but there was nothing else for mm-hmm. them. And so in conversations with several of them, they were saying to me, we have no base of support. And some of them were saying they were happy to see me here. They didn't know me before, but you know, now they had found somebody who was in a position here at the university that they could feel comfortable coming and talking to. Okay. And so that also sort of weighed on my mind pretty heavily, that here you have young people who are facing a dilemma that most people don't even think about. And that is, you are African American, Native American, or Hispanic. In those days, we didn't have the targeted Asians initially. And you see a group of people, young people, your peers, who come from backgrounds very similar to yours. They are functioning at a level different than the one that you have always achieved and want to continue. And so they were really torn between interacting, socializing, with spending a lot of time with the students who were struggling academically, and really setting lower goals for themselves. If they were able to achieve at an average level, this was considered quite an accomplishment for them. It's not because they weren't capable mm-hmm. of doing so mm-hmm. much more, but that was what had been communicated mm-hmm. to them, that if you can earn C's and a few B's, then that's just wonderful. Nobody expected them. And so they didn't expect themselves to achieve at any higher levels. Then you have this handful or more, and I couldn't have identified a handful then, but you know, the few that I came in contact with, who had always achieved at high levels and expected that of themselves. When it came to academics, they couldn't really study with, function with, the larger number of students who were here as a result of the programming outreach. And so they then had to decide, do you associate with people whose goals and aspirations are similar to yours? Or do you simply associate with people who are the same color, who belong to the same ethnic and cultural backgrounds, but whose goals and aspirations are not yours? So if they wanted to do well academically, they needed to be associating with the students who were achieving mm-hmm. at high levels. Mm-hmm. Those students, most of the time, were Caucasian. If they associated with them, then they had to deal with the kind of messages that came from members of their own group, that they were trying to be other than they were. And mm-hmm. in those days, you know, you heard very frequently the Oreo mm-hmm. and all of the other mm-hmm. Labels that people put on them. And I thought, you know, for young people who are getting an education, trying to meet the goals and aspirations that they and their families have set for themselves. They know that they can. To have to deal with this kind of issue with an in-group and out-group peers, that was just most unreasonable and unfortunate, and that the university needed to be doing something differently than it was to provide a more wholesome and supportive environment for these young people. So they were too few in number, and then they had to deal with those kinds of issues as well. One of the students shared with me, actually she had come from a class that day, and they had their test papers returned. And so there were a lot of students standing in line to talk to the professor at the end because of their concern for the grade that they had received. So as the line got shorter, you know, you could hear what the professor was saying to the people in front of you. And she said there were two white young women immediately in front of her. And so when they talked to the professor, they were saying, you know, I earned a B on this test, and I studied really hard, and I, you know, have always achieved at higher levels. And so this young woman was saying that she could hear what the professor was saying to other members of her class, all of whom were white, before it was her turn. And he was talking to them about what they could do to improve their grade in the course. And when she walked up, the question was, well, young lady, what can I do for you? And so she started hers at, well, I'm very concerned about my grade in this course. And so she said, he said, well, what did you get on the test? And she said, a C. And the response was, you got a C on that test? And she said, yes. You really got a C on it? And she said, yes. And he said, well, that's a perfectly good score. And here was a young woman who had just earned the first C in her life. And that was the response. So for me, it was a confirmation of the low expectations that so many of our faculty and staff had for students from different backgrounds, but especially those from ethnic and racial backgrounds. He didn't know that this was a young woman who was extremely bright and was distressed because she had received this low grade and knew that she could do better. She had studied well, and she too wanted to find out, well, what kinds of things, you know, should I be doing, should I do differently so that I can achieve at a level that is commensurate with my abilities. And so she walked over, she said she was just looking for somebody, anybody, to talk with, and saw my light on and knocked on the door. That happened several times. And so I thought, we've got to really work at changing a whole culture here, because there are too many people who simply think when they see a minority student that this is a student who's here because of the affirmative action programs that the university has, and that their abilities are not at the level that one would expect on a campus of this nature and prestige. So you could see just how very systemic this whole thing could become for a student who was really very bright, who had always excelled, to be in an environment where nobody expected them to achieve at a high level. It was just devastating. And you could see people losing their levels of confidence and their abilities.
Oh, sure.
You know, thinking that, you know, maybe they're right, you know, maybe I just can't do it. And there was nobody telling them that they could. So with those and similar and other similar experiences, it just became so clear to me that the university had to attract, had to do something to attract a larger number of students who were academically talented and outstanding. And no matter how you pursued it, it didn't seem to be a possibility. And I'm sure that people had talked about a variety of scholarships before I came, and there were conversations about scholarships again when I was here during my first year. But most of that conversation focused on having scholarships that would be given again to students with financial need. Mm-hmm. Merit was not a part of it. Mm-hmm. And so,
so you began to talk about this in a variety of settings?
And I suppose some of my colleagues in those days would say, I've talked to any and everybody.
Well, who were you talking to? Were you just talking to...
to colleagues on the staff, and to staff who were in the program areas, who were heading up the various units that had these special programs. And even among some minority staff mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. The concern was not with those students who would be merit achievers. Mm-hmm. It was really with access and opportunity, as it should have been. But we certainly shouldn't have stopped there. And that was, I think, the shortcoming of the institution mm-hmm. in its thinking about these issues at that time, that they focused on those. You want to provide the opportunity, you want to give the access. And so these programs were designed to bring these students here, to give them the academic support that they thought they needed, mm-hmm. and to help them become successful students. And all of us know, but we act like we don't sometimes, that you don't really overcome those kinds of academic and educational deficits in a short period of time. They weren't developed in a short period of time, and so you're not going to overcome them with, you know, a few remedies here mm-hmm. and there. But that seemed always to be the expectation. And you'd hear people say, well, but we have all these programs, but they don't seem to be making any difference. Well, we're educators, and we knew this is where the research is being done, that other folks use. Sometimes I used to say, I don't think we pay any attention to it ourselves. We know a lot about learning and achievement, but we weren't using that information in our programmatic outreach to students who came from different kinds of backgrounds. But the more I thought of it and looked at what was happening here, it seemed to me that we had to take that next important mm-hmm. step, and that was to reflect the same kinds of diversity, talents, and abilities among our minority populations, as among and within our minority populations, that occurred naturally for our majority student populations.
Now, when you said you talked to different groups about this, was their reaction basically sympathetic? Did they say, no, this just can't be done? How were the initial reactions to this?
Some people listened politely mm-hmm. and nodded their heads affirmatively, but once that conversation was over, mm-hmm. that was the mm-hmm. end of it. And I could pretty quickly know who would not be helpful in one way or the other with this. But I'm pretty determined when I see a need mm-hmm. or there is a challenge and I can see a remedy for it, that I don't give up quite so easily. And so I kept talking. And in that process, I was refining my own mm-hmm. thinking about mm-hmm. this as well.
Right.
And some responded very negatively. Would say initially that, we don't offer scholarships to any students. You know, we have lots of bright students who come here, and we don't offer them scholarships. And that was to say to me, and we shouldn't be offering them to, you know, anybody else. And I think the comment that really, as some people would say, that sort of set my feet firmly on the ground, and I knew I was going to continue to work at this, was when a colleague took my concerns about our need to attract talented students from minority populations to a high-level meeting on this campus, and the response from the person in charge at that time was, there weren't any minority students who could be considered merit.
Oh my.
That colleague came back to my office just next door after the meeting, and he was as white as a sheet. When I looked at him, I knew that something was wrong. And so my first question was, what's wrong? What happened? And he said, I have to sit down. And he sat down and he shared the story. He was distraught, never expected to hear that from a top administrator on this campus. And this was from a friend of his. And so I said at that point, I'm really sorry, but I'm not surprised. I understand your surprise and your pain. And I'm sorry that had to happen. But I'm not surprised to hear that at all. And I said, but we'll have to show them that there are bright students out there, and that that kind of talent and ability occurs as naturally in these populations as it does in a Caucasian population. And we'll just have to show them that that's the case.
Is this what you call a defining moment?
Or
at least for
this
gentleman, it certainly
yeah.
was, your colleague, excuse
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. But I think it also, you know, he was always certainly in agreement and supportive mm-hmm. of what he was hearing from me, but I think this also strengthened his resolve to continue to work with me in getting this forwarded, move forward. And so after that, I began to think more about how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And little did I know that at the end of that year, Joe Corey and Roger Howard would come as emissaries to talk to me about taking over the responsibility from the administrative level for minority recruitment and retention here at the university.
Now that position had been held?
It had been held previously by majority staff.
Okay.
So Roger had done it for 1 year.
Yeah. Now there had been someone, I think Roger mentioned his name was Lee Hansen.
Lee
he had
Hansen.
Done that before.
Mm-hmm.
And then he...
And Joe had, well Joe and
left.
Lee had worked together.
Yeah.
Joe had always kind of been involved, but Lee Hansen had that portion
mm-hmm.
of the responsibility.
And then he left the university for
he
whatever
left.
Reason.
Right.
And then Roger took it over
right.
on a half-time basis, was that
mm-hmm.
it? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he approached you with Joe
yes.
to assume that.
To do that.
I think Roger told me he thought it would be better, from his point of view, to have someone with a higher profile in there. He was delighted to recommend you. So, were you excited about assuming this position? Was this something that you
no,
were?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
And I had made it pretty clear to everyone who knew me that my training was no different than theirs, that I went through the same hoops that they did to earn my degrees, and that I didn't bring any particular expertise mm-hmm. to the area, and so I didn't want to work in a minority-focused area. It was not that I lacked commitment, concern, interest, or any of those things. But I did not want to be pigeonholed in that manner. And that sort of goes back to an earlier conversation that I had had with Brad Curl.
Brad Curl was the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs.
And shortly after accepting or working in the position as Assistant Dean of Students, I was interested in other opportunities here at the university and decided that I should go talk to him because I wanted something that was a bit more academic. And I made my appointment and went down to talk with him. And in the course of that conversation, I think I surprised Bri more than he surprised me in that one, because he, you know, clearly knew who I was and had heard from Paul and others about my capabilities and competencies and that kind of thing. So in that sense, he had some knowledge of who I was. And so I was saying to him that I had done the kind of Dean of Students thing earlier in my career, and I wanted to do something that was more academically oriented, because I had left a tenured professor position when I came to the university. And while I knew that with my degrees and the lack of research that I was not going to get a faculty position, that I certainly wanted something that was more involved in the academic arena. And Bri was encouraging to the extent that he thought that that might happen at some point. And I said to him that I was disappointed when I arrived on this campus, because I had heard so much about how liberal it was, and that is for many years. And so when I was finally deciding to move to Madison, I expected to see minority people in all kinds of positions all around this campus. And then I was extremely disappointed to find that that was not the case. And little did I know that I was already kind of elevating his temperature as I started to talk about this. And I said to him that it was quite disappointing to see that we had fewer minority people in positions of leadership and authority on this campus than many of our peer institutions. And that all of them were in minority-focused areas, except, I said, five. And he told me that was not true. There were more in general program areas here at the university. And I said, well, I identified five. And he said, name them. So I started naming, and I couldn't get five this time. I could only get three or four. And he said, there are more. And I said, well, you name them. And he didn't name them either. I think he knew that what I was saying was true, but it was hard to admit it. And so I said, what you've done, in essence, is to resegregate the university. You brought minority staff here, or you hired them because they were here, but you've kept them in areas that are peripheral to the mission of the university. And I said, that does not suggest any commitment to me. That if you're committed, then you look at the talents and abilities of people, irrespective of their racial status, and you would have them in other kinds of positions. And I haven't told this many places, and I would not want this told many places. Bri said to me that many of them would not be here if the university did not have these special programs. But he said, but that's not true for you. Well, you can imagine what someone in my position would think about that, and I did. But I also knew that it was time for me to end my conversation with Bri, or I would never have an opportunity to do anything else here at the university. So I graciously thanked him and asked him to keep me in mind, and I excused myself because I knew that I had touched an area that was very sensitive. And so I left. I came back to my office. Paul came in to say, well, how did it go? And I told him. And Paul then started saying, oh my goodness, I should have talked to Bri before you went down there. And I'm really sorry I didn't. And I said, why? Well, I should have. And I said, no, you shouldn't have to do that. And he said, no, I should have talked to Bri so that he would have known who you are before you came. And I said, what would you have said to him? He said, well, I would have told him that he couldn't BS you the way he has done other people. And I said, well, perhaps it's good that it happened that way, but if there are no opportunities for me after this, I'll understand. Well, little did I know that within perhaps, I don't remember the exact time, but certainly it must have been within a year, thereabouts. Then here people would be coming and asking me to consider taking over these responsibilities and being on the Vice Chancellor's staff.
Now, what year was this about?
It must have been in 79, 79, 80. I'm sure that's about when it was. Because when Joe and Roger first talked to me, I said no. I was not interested, and restated why I was not interested. And of course, both of them understood, but still tried to help me understand that it was a role where I could make some significant contributions. And I held fast to my position that I did not want to do it. So, they said, well, all right, you know, we'll talk to you again. And so the next time we talked, they asked me what I thought should be done in the area to make it more effective.
Not by they, you're saying Joe and Roger.
Roger,
okay.
So it was, you know, kind of simply the way those two function. Would you consider writing, you know, some ideas of what you think would be effective? So obviously I'd say, well, sure, I'll do that. So I did write briefly some things that I thought would be more effective than the way we were currently functioning. And then Joe or Roger, or maybe both of them, said to me at some time a few days later that they had shared what I had written with the Vice Chancellor, and I guess the Chancellor and they were impressed, and they still wanted me to do it.
Now, what you wrote was essentially what you've been talking about here.
It was about the campus-wide picture,
okay,
and how we might do things differently,
okay,
and more effectively. I don't think I even put anything in there about merit scholarships.
Okay.
It was more organizational.
Right.
And so then one, if not both of them, told me later that they had shared it with the Vice Chancellor, and they were very interested and thought that my suggestions were good, and that they were going now, perhaps more than ever, to try to convince me to do it. And I made it clear again that I did not want to do it. And so they said, well, we've talked to you twice, and now Bri has said to us that he does not want us to talk to you anymore, that he will do it himself. Well, in the meantime, Paul knew that I didn't want to do that. So, and he wanted to keep me on his staff, mm-hmm. but also to help me. He talked to Bri and told him why he needed me on the staff. And he went on to talk about what I was doing and how I was the best trained counselor on his staff. And whenever he had tough issues, that he made the referrals to me. That whenever he had faculty or staff who needed to see somebody, he referred them to me. And that he needed me on his staff for that kind of counseling and assistance for people who were experiencing great difficulties. I was also seeing people who were gay, mm-hmm. both men and women, and getting lots of referrals from various places around the campus. And he told me that Bri's response after he had gone through all of this to what he was saying was, well, these are all the reasons why we want her in this position. Because they needed somebody who had these kinds of skills, but who was also obviously an effective communicator, who was persuasive, and he just went down a whole list of things. And then said to Paul as well that he didn't want anybody else talking to me, that he would do it himself. So I said, that's not fair. But of course, no, I didn't say that to him at the moment, mm-hmm. nor did mm-hmm. anybody tell him. I said it was mm-hmm. unfair, I'm sure. So within a reasonable period of time, Bri had someone in his office to contact me and to say that he wanted to see me. So I went down and we talked, and I stated again why I didn't want to work in this area. He agreed with me, he understood that, but also said that they needed someone with my skills, and that was why they continued to talk to me. And I could express my appreciation for the recognition of the skills and levels of competency that I had, but I simply did not want to do it. So finally, Bri said to me, well, you say that you're committed to this area. And I said, I am. And there is no question about that. So he said, well, how can you turn down an opportunity to really make a difference if you have that level of commitment? And I said, for the reasons that I told you. And so then we got into, if I didn't accepted, what would he do? And he told me he wouldn't appoint anybody. And I said, well, you can't do that. And he said, well, we're offering it to the person that we want, and you're turning us down. So I said, this is unfair, Bri, because here you are, the number two person on this campus, and you're asking me to do something. And it's clear I don't want to do it. It is also clear that somebody needs to do it. And I can't keep saying no to you, because the first time I said no to him, we talked a second time. And I said, I can't keep saying no to you, because if I ever am considered for any other position on this campus, having turned this down, you will not consider me positively. And he said, oh, that's not true. And I said, it is, because you're human just like the rest of us. And humans, when they want something and it doesn't quite happen that way, you don't forget. And I said, so you have me boxed in. I can't keep saying no if I'm going to stay here. And he still said that was not true. And I said, Brian, you and I both know it is. So then we started talking about how we might do it. And I said, I would only consider it if I could do it on leave from the Dean's mm-hmm. Student's Office. And So that would allow me the opportunity to come back to the Dean of Student Staff if I didn't like it. And I said, it also gives you the opening that you need, because you may not be satisfied with me in this position. So that way we have a mutual agreement that if I'm not doing what you want me to do, you can send me back. And if I'm not liking what I'm doing, then I can go back. So that was the way we did this initially. And he continued to tell me why he wanted me in that position, what he thought I could do, and also the benefits that would be derived from me in terms of learning the campus, how it works, from that position. And he said, you'll learn more about this institution and how best to get things done from this position than you ever will where you are now. And that it was the place where I could really make a significant difference. Mm-hmm. And so we went back and forth about salary and all of that. And so it was really an interesting negotiating session between the two of us after a short time. And I finally asked him to give me some more time to think about it. And he gave me that time. And then when I went back, I was still not ready to commit. And we talked further about the salary. Little did I know that people on the staff down here in the Dean of Students office and others who knew both Brad Curl and me were really quite nervous about what was going on between the two of us, because Brad's reputation at that time was one where he was very decisive, mm-hmm. and if people didn't do what he wanted to have done, then he moved on. And they knew that I was still talking with him, and they were just fearful of what was going to happen. And they didn't tell me until after I finally made the decision, and then they just said, oh my God, we've been walking on eggs down here for you, because we didn't know how that was going to work out if you kept saying no to him. Or, you know, if he got to the place where he thought you were taking too long to make your decision and he no longer wanted you to do it. And I said, well, that's interesting. I didn't know all of that about him, but I did say to him in the course of that conversation that I was surprised that he would even consider me for that position, given our initial conversation. Mm-hmm. And he said it was for that reason that he really wanted me, because he knew that I would stand up for what was right, that I wouldn't let them get away with doing less than they could or should, and that I would never embarrass them in public. And he said, you have all the other skills that we'd look for. And little did I know at that time that this would become one of the best working relationships, one of the best mentoring relationships that anyone could ever have. Bri was, and some people will say became, a very different person throughout our relationship than they had seen at earlier times.
How so?
He didn't really attack people as much as he had done in the past. He had a reputation for just really sort of destroying folks.
He was a tough guy.
Well, a tough guy. That's what I heard.
Yeah.
And I think I saw it only once before I joined his staff. And I never saw it throughout the time I was on his staff at all. And people couldn't believe how he and I interacted on just a whole range of issues. They couldn't believe that I would disagree with him, that I would challenge him on stuff. And I think it's because he had that reputation and people feared how he might react.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I knew that, we needed to discuss things. And he was just wonderful in his ability to negotiate. He was one of certainly the brightest and most creative persons you could ever know. And if I would go in with an idea about something that I thought needed to be done, he argued the other side of it. And I soon developed my own strategy for working with him, and that was not to let him make a quick decision, because if he did, he'd make a decision that I probably didn't want him to. So I'd present an idea and say, "Now, I don't want a decision today. I want you to think about this, and we'll talk about it the next time." Well, it was not unlike Bri at all. The next time I went in, if I didn't bring it up, he would. And sometimes I said, "No, I'm not ready to discuss that today. We'll do that the next time." He said, "Well, you said the next time." I said, "Okay, but I'm not ready to discuss that." And when I would finally get to it again, because I wanted to get my thinking clear before I engaged in this conversation with him, he would say, "All right, let's talk about whatever the issue was." And he would take my position that I had expressed the previous time and present it to me then as his.
Mm.
And I'd say, "But Brian, wait a minute, that was not your position, that was mine."
You tell him what he said and you go back and forth, and then what?
And then he'd kind of, have this twinkle in his eye, and he'd say, "Well, you did such a good job defending that position. I want to see what you're going to do with this one." little did I know that Bri had used that strategy with his children all of their lives. Mm. And at his memorial service, it was just really great to hear his daughter say that he had always done that with them. There was nothing, it seemed to me, that Bri didn't know.
Mm.
Nor anyone that he didn't know on this campus. He had the most incredible institutional memory that I think it's possible for anybody to have. I mean, details. And was just an extraordinary writer, very creative thinker. And when I used to draft stuff for him, he could read what I had written upside down as well as I could read it right side up. And he would start editing when he hadn't read the whole piece. And so one day I said to him, "Bri, you didn't read everything that I wrote." And he said, and he stopped and he said, "Well." And I said, "Well, how do you know what else I'm saying in this piece if you haven't read the whole?" And he said, "So you're having problems with my revisions?" I said, "Not really, it's just intimidating that you can sit here and not read the whole piece and just start editing and revising all the way through." So one of my goals was finally to write something one day for him that he would not revise. And I did have that experience.
Oh, you did? Oh, yes. Congratulations. Those can often go unfulfilled.
Yes.
Those
that was wonderful when I finally did that. But Bri developed, and I'm saying developed because people didn't think he had that level of commitment before. Perhaps it was already always there, but just had not been revealed or unfolded in those ways. But I couldn't have worked with a person who was more skilled as an administrator and as an individual, and he brought levels of commitment that I think surprised a whole lot of folks in those years. And was willing, to take risks. And Joe Corey was among those who said that I had converted him to being a Baptist. He was Mormon, as you know. And it wasn't that I had converted him to much of anything. But as was my habit, and certainly it made sense programmatically, because Joe was on Bri's staff as well, and I was working both in the minority area and in academic services mm-hmm. with Joe. So he and I would meet with Bri from time to time on a variety of subjects that might be minority focused or academic services. And on a couple of occasions when we were meeting with him and it was on some minority focused issue, and I would suggest that perhaps we needed to do thus and so, and Bri would say, okay, he'd get up and walk right to the phone and call anybody on this campus and mm-hmm. say, you know, we've been thinking about it, and this is what we are considering.
Boy, that's nice.
Yes, and Joe would walk out of those meetings with me and say, I have never seen Bri act that way with anybody, and I'd say, why? He said, you make a suggestion about something that needs to be done, and Bri acts on it immediately. So I said, well, I didn't know that, you know, that hadn't happened. So then when I started on this mission of developing a merit-based scholarship mm-hmm. for the university, the responses that I got almost everywhere related to the fact that it should be need-based, not merit.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the whole campus seemed to me to be oriented toward need-based assistance only. And they just, you know, would hear it, but not hear it.
So you were trying to change the culture of that whole approach to scholarships. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I saw that real change could occur on this campus in terms of students from these various populations, and that the students and the staff could sort of stand up straight, mm-hmm. if you will, and be confident that they could come here and excel, and that there were some people who knew that they had those kinds of abilities. And that even for those who were at academic risk, that they could always do better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they didn't have to settle for mediocrity. They could go beyond that. And I wanted them to think of themselves in that way. And I wanted others to think of their possibilities and not their limitations.
Did you ever get discouraged?
No, I don't. Usually,
that's not a word that's real high up in your vocabulary.
No.
I remember my mother reading me the story of the little engine that could when
Absolutely.
I was a child. When did you begin to feel on the scholarship issue that maybe you could really start changing, that the culture actually might change?
Well, I kind of always thought that it would. I'm not a negative thinker. I'm an optimist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I respond to challenges quite well, and try to figure out ways to, you know, surmount whatever obstacles that are there. And I had a sense that this was the right thing
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for this institution
that
to
helps,
do.
That helps, doesn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was talking to Bri initially, after I had talked to many others around, I would simply say to him, Bri, the university made the right decisions. Because when I first started saying, he said, Bri, minority staff believe this too. And I said, I understand that. Because that was the right decision
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I want you to look at it in this way, that was step one. You don't stop at step one. There's a step two. And this institution did not take the next important step, and it's time to do that. And when I, you know, just kept hammering away at that notion and saying to him to remain at that first level or that first step really reinforced stereotypic notions and ideas. It really enhanced notions and feelings of prejudice that existed in this university community, and that the only way we could change it would be then to bring in some students who were highly qualified and to have them interacting and enriching this community, because their goals and aspirations were no different than the majority students who were excelling. And that they would be role models, certainly to those students who were struggling, but that they would be role models for all students. I never really accepted the fact that they would simply be role models for other minority students, but that they would be role models for all students. And that our students, majority students, needed to have the opportunity to know some bright and talented young people who were minority, because they too were developing these stereotypic notions, or they were extending them and believing that they were true. And when they see those kinds of figures out there about the retention and graduation rates, what more do you need? And so I thought, we've just got to do this. And so I could talk to Bri about it wasn't necessarily perhaps as politically astute as some might think, but it was the right thing to do. And that if we really cared about the education of those who were disenfranchised, who were kind of at the bottom economically and otherwise, that this was the one of the only ways that we could begin to move beyond that. And that this university would not have to be constantly faced with a situation where it's believed to be prejudiced and discriminatory. And that's why so few of these populations were here in the first place. And also why many didn't want to come, because they didn't think that this would be a good environment in which they could thrive. Or parents wouldn't think, parents of minority students, wouldn't think that their kids could come here and have good experiences. And there were those who said in my days in the Dean of Students office that they really liked this institution in terms of the quality of education that it provided, but they would not allow their sons or daughters to come here because the university's focus was exclusively on students at academic risk. And these parents would say, I don't want my children viewed only as people who lack certain kinds of abilities and talents and experiences. I want people to see their potential. And that won't happen at the University of Wisconsin at Madison at this time. And I think they were right. So when you, you know, really see that something needs to be done, and it is a change that can, however slowly, make a real difference, then you continue to work at it. And I knew that, you know, increasingly I had the support of colleagues with whom I had talked, and some influential ones. It was never an issue or difficult for Joe Corey to understand, for Roger Howard to understand, or for Jim Churchill to understand when I would talk to them about these kinds of issues and how we could make some difference here. And that our failure to do it, or our refusal to do it, would indicate that we weren't committed to having our own experiences opened, enriched, and enhanced by associations that we could have with people who were clearly on the same level that we were. And you can see that when, you know, you see people like yourself who are always considered an exception. And I kept saying to them, we're not exceptions. There are a whole lot of us out there. You just don't know them. And we need to have more of them here.
So how did you go about, how did it finally occur that Bri was so on that?
I decided I'd talk to him several times and that I needed to put something in writing. And I figured if I put it in writing and talked about institutional racism, that it would have a greater impact. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote my first little piece, one very lengthy, and shared it with him, and he and I talked about it, and I thought, okay, I've got to refine this. And I said that to him, now this is a draft. Mm-hmm. I'm going to work on it some more, but I just want you to see what I'm thinking about here. And Bri, always the teacher, would you know, always respond in terms of, well, what about this? Well, you know, what about that? And how would you handle this? And so I worked on the revision of that proposal, shared it with Roger, also with Joe, and, you know, they'd give me feedback. And so finally I said to Joe that I was going to have this appointment with Bri to talk about this merit scholarship, because we had explored getting state funds and they weren't available. Mm-hmm. Bri told me they wouldn't be, but I thought they could be. And so he said, well, you can check, and we did. So we, you know, went at every level in the system. And it was clear that there would be no money for, no state dollars for a merit scholarship for minority students.
For undergraduate.
Mm-hmm. And as I had mentioned to you at some earlier time, we had the AOF mm-hmm. in the graduate school, and I thought
Advanced Opportunity Fellowships for graduate students, mm-hmm. yes.
That we could have a parallel program mm-hmm. for undergraduates, that it would make all the sense in the world. Mm-hmm. But that was not to be. So the only choice left to us was to raise private funds. So when I, in the conversation with Bri before Joe joined me mm-hmm. at my request, he said to me, well, who do you think is going to contribute to this scholarship if it is approved? He said, there aren't enough minorities who have received their degrees and are well enough along in their careers that they could contribute to it. So where is the money going to come from? And I said, Bri, from people like you, who know why this situation exists, and who know that it should not continue. So I said, I expect white people who are well informed to help support the scholarship, because they know that something needs to be done. And it was funny, and he just said, well, you could be right. And I said, in time, minorities will, but we can't expect them to make huge contributions because they don't have those kind of resources. Mm-hmm. And I said, and even if some did, they probably wouldn't give it to a scholarship at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They look at this place as having all the money it needs. Mm-hmm. They'd probably be looking at some of the historically black institutions and giving their money there. And I said, at this point, still so many got their early training in those institutions. Mm-hmm. So no, we don't expect it from them. But this is, and so I said, so you and your friends, and I know that you're going to talk to your friends, and you will help to raise the money that is needed for this. So then, of course, I refined my proposal and then said to Joe that in the next conversation with Bri, I wanted him to join me. And he and Bri both had a way in those days of saying to me, okay, boss, what is it you want me to do? They pretended that I bossed them instead of the way it really was. And so I shared with him my proposal, revised proposal, and I said, now I'm going to give Bri a copy of this, but I'm going to tell him what's in it and why we should do this. And I said, and then when I'm done, I want you to say to him, Bri, you may be right that we can't do this, but we'll never know unless we try. Mm. So let us try it. So he said, okay, we went in. I did what I said I was going to do. And then Joe said to Bri, you know, Bri, you're right about most things. And you may be right about this one. We don't know that. And he said, all we're asking for is that you give us a window. Let us try it. And he said, why don't you consider 3 years? Let us work at it. And if we're successful, then we continue. If we're not, we'll give it up. And he looked at me.
And you'll know that.
Right, well, no. Right. But he looked at me as if to say, now, Marcio, you will give it up. If it doesn't work. So, Bryce said, all right, I'll talk to the chancellor about it. So we walked out with great enthusiasm. I thought, all right, that's all I need is for him to talk to Irv.
Shame.
Mm-hmm. And so the next time I went in to see Bri on another issue, before I could hardly sit down, he said, well, I have good news for you. And I said, oh? He said, the chancellor says that you can proceed in developing the scholarship. Mm-hmm. And without thinking where I was, I jumped up, hands in the air, and said, wow! And when I realized I was in the vice chancellor's office, you know, it just said, sit down, Marcel, be calm, be dignified. So I sat back down, and he said, but your work has just begun. Now you've got to figure out how to do this.
Right.
And he said, your greatest challenges are going to come from other minority staff, and from Wally Dahlman, the director of financial aid. She said, Wally is committed to need-based assistance. So he and his staff are going to have difficulties with this. So you'll have to convince him and other minority staff, because they have not been supportive of a merit scholarship either. And I said, I know. And I said, but I also know, Brian, that you will continue to help me figure out how to do this and find my way through whatever I need to here at this institution. And he said, well, of course I'm going to do that. So no sooner than, you know, we have the approval to do it, we started strategizing about how we would proceed. And we knew that. And he said, you know, very quickly, you can't raise funds without an institutional commitment. And he said, you'll need to talk to the people in the foundation. And I said, whom should I start with there? And he said, well, Irv will talk to Bob Rennebaum. And perhaps Martha Taylor is the person that you would be working most closely with. And he said, we need to have some indication of an institutional commitment. And that is, people who are important to the university have signed on and are willing to contribute. So we decided to write a letter to faculty. Now, we have had a standing faculty senate committee on the academic affairs of minority students. And I had staffed that committee, as Roger had and as Lee had before me. And so I also presented it to them, and I kept them informed as I was in the final stages and talking to Bri. And they too agreed that we should send a letter to the faculty, telling them about the establishment of the scholarship approach and fundraising, and asking for contributions. And a number of people did contribute. There were a few very interesting and angry letters that came back. And Brian and I...
Angry in what sense?
that this should not be done, and that we certainly shouldn't be asking people to contribute, and that the students weren't doing well here, and you know, it would be a continuation of poor retention and graduation, that many of these students from these populations weren't capable of functioning at this level. So all the stuff that you
that
would normally
fighting for years.
But the response was, I think, positive overall, and some people really said this has been needed for a long time, and we'll do whatever we can to assist. So we had many planning meetings, developed an advisory committee, and I think I had given you the names of the people who served on that. And we,
but that will be found in the your file in the unit in the oral history project, the list of those names.
Okay, so, good.
Just so people know that.
Because those people were really very important again in helping to think through the best ways to proceed with this. And it was not easy for the foundation, or at least as Martha Taylor expressed it, to think about raising money for scholarships, because they had not done that before. They had some scholarship funds in the foundation, but those were donor-driven. People who wanted to give money to the university for scholarships would do it, but they had never raised money or attempted to raise money.
Big difference.
And so their thoughts were that it couldn't be done either, or that it was going to be extremely difficult. And so we heard that almost every time. And sometimes it felt like in one meeting we'd make progress, and then in the next one we'd be starting at ground zero all over again. So those were some of the initial frustrations, but never such that I thought we couldn't do it. So Brian Irv agreed that we could hire a part-time person to do the fundraising, and we couldn't have them in academic services where, or on the vice chancellor staff where I was located, that person had to be someplace else. And obviously the someplace else was the foundation. And of course we didn't have money to, you know, hire a person immediately, so those negotiations had to take place between Irv and Bob Rennebaum to free up some resources at least for a half-time person. And then we decided that that person would work with me in the program area to assist in the development of the program. And no sooner than we got the person in place, who was Marion Brown, and certainly one of the wisest decisions that we could have made at that time. Marion knew the campus.
She had been working in human ecology, hadn't
right.
she?
Well, it was something else at that time.
Yeah, family resources and consumer science or something.
She had
like
been
that.
A faculty member there, so knew the university and how it functions, but was comfortable in the community. And it didn't take much, I'd say today, she might think differently and as she's recalling this, for certainly me to convince her that this would be an extraordinary opportunity for her, that she would get to know more people all across this nation than she would ever have that opportunity to meet otherwise. People, you know, with money everywhere. And that she was the person for this position. And I tell her that she would be like a fish in water. And certainly that has been borne out. We had thought that we would keep her in the two kind of half-time positions for the full 3 years. But once she was on the foundation staff, Bob Rennebaum became so impressed with her that they, and Tim Raleigh, that they wanted to hire her full-time in the foundation. we discussed this a couple of times, but agreed that if that were to happen, and Brian Joe convinced me that that was a good thing to have happen, that it would not affect the scholarship, that she would still raise money for the scholarship. And she wanted to do that as well. Because Marion, I often say that she's my soulmate, has the same level of commitment to this program to this day that I have. And we have worked extremely well together. And we sort of carry on the same kind of Socratic method that Brian and I practice together. So we argue both sides, all sides of all issues. And I think we come out with better decisions having done that. So it was really very fortunate for us that we were able to get her, that she did the caliber of work that the foundation wanted her full time, and certainly that advanced the fundraising for the program in many significant ways. And the other thing that IRV did at that time, we knew that we wanted to begin offering scholarships, because it's hard to raise money telling people you're going to provide a scholarship, that it would be really helpful if we could have a few scholarships in place and then go out to raise the money. And so IRV made a bequest of, I think, $80,000 or $84,000, somewhere between $84,000 and $85,000 available to the program that had been donated by or from the estate of a black man with a degree in philosophy from this institution. And so that was a big boost for us to get that much money in one sum, and then the contributions that we were getting from faculty. And from the beginning, we set up the faculty process so that they could do it on installment. And many people set theirs up for years, for more than a year. So it would be, you know, 5 years or whatever, they'd be contributing certain amounts from their salaries. So I think we were extremely lucky with these sources of funds so that we could offer scholarships beginning in the fall of 1984.
The question is how you approached alumni groups, how successful you were.
We worked with contacts that we could develop on our own. Marion, as I said, knew a lot of people because she had been here for a number of years. And then with the people that we had on the advisory committee, and then the next version of that committee, we would contact a variety of people and ask them for information on other alums that they knew. And this really became a very beneficial outreach for the university, because we were able to provide information on minority alums that the Alumni Association had no records of at all. So Marion, through our work, really provided some very valuable information for the ROS program that's housed in the registrar's office, used by the Alumni Association as well. So we could see, and others could see on campus, that these kind of collaborative efforts paid off for more than just our outreach to try to contact people for fundraising purposes. But people would respond and say, well, you know, I've not been contacted by the university before, and or I wasn't interested because they weren't doing anything that had any value to me, but this really is something that I'd like to be a part of. And so we've, you know, just sort of expanded each contact you made. That one opened up maybe some five or six other contacts that we didn't know about. As a matter of fact, we just had this fall the establishment of a book award for Lester Dugas, who received his degree from here. He and his wife both received their degrees from here in 1949. And we got in touch with them. And they were just wonderful and opening their lovely home to people in the Chicago area, contacting all the people that they knew, giving us the information so that we could in turn contact them. And so they became a good link to many alums who had been here from the early 40s onward. And so one contact just led to many others.
That's great.
And then we'd make our contacts with them, sometimes make visits if we thought it was worth our, you know, going to talk to folks. And it was just really a great experience to have this happening all over the place. And to bring minority alums back in contact with this university when they didn't feel they had any reason to be before. Yeah. So.
Of course. Just two more questions today, and then I think we can finish this in a brief interview next week sometime. You said that when Bri Curl approved this, he said you're going to be fighting two battles: one with the registrar, with Wally Dalma from Financial Services, and the other with some of the minority staff. Mm-hmm. How was he right about those, and were you able to overcome those? Or how well were you able? What happened?
he was right. There are, you know, people who really get committed to, as I said earlier, the notions of access and opportunity. So we want to expand the number from these underrepresented populations mm-hmm. that have the opportunity to go to college. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the niche that they focus on. And sometimes when you do that, you think any other approach is really going to take away from this one mm-hmm. that you're committed to. And that's where you see the greatest gains being made. And it's not that that's necessarily true, but that's the way they're viewing it mm-hmm. at that point. And there are people who think that many, and especially majority people, are only interested in those who are, quote, most like them in terms of their abilities, their goals, their experiences, and their aspirations. And so merit always seemed easy mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for them, mm-hmm. whereas getting in larger populations of those who would never have the opportunity to go to college was more difficult, and that's where the focus should be made. And Wally and his staff were clearly committed to need-based mm-hmm. assistance. And that's not unusual, I think, for a staff that has the majority of its funds coming from state and federal resources, yeah, and right. those were need-based.
Yeah, right.
And this institution for a long time had not been cultivating getting the kind of resources that some of our peer institutions have, nor did this institution make the kind of decision that many of our public peers made back in the early 60s, they really set aside monies for both need and merit-based mm-hmm. considerations. Wisconsin, because of the populist philosophy that exists here and that is historical, did not make that decision. And so that's why we've had to come at it in different mm-hmm. ways. Because when I talk to people at Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and other places like that, there was never an issue of resources. They had them,
yeah.
But this campus didn't. And so Wally and his staff, while you know committed to need-based awards, really didn't have any other resources to do anything else with. And so they too had this very strong commitment, and they were on target in terms of increasing the number who would come from populations that never would have had the opportunity to go to college without these kinds of resources. But I think not understanding, certainly I would say on the part of Wally and his staff, because most of them were majority people at that time, not understanding that people who come then from the lower socioeconomic levels didn't envision that they would have the opportunity to go to college. And so their preparation for that experience would be different than those who had grown up in environments where they always knew that they were going to college. Now, you know, contrast that with a parent who says to a child who may be really quite bright, there's no need in your thinking about going to college. I can't afford to send you. You won't have the opportunity to go. Or to say, I don't know why you're spending all of that time studying. It's not going to amount to anything because you can't go to college. Or, I didn't go to college and I did all right. So, in other words, you don't need to go either. So there would be little incentive and motivation from children who come, in those days, who came from very poor backgrounds, to think that college was ever an option for them. So they didn't prepare. Education was not as valued in those environments, in those homes, because they knew that they couldn't afford it. So those students generally will be less well prepared than those who came from sometimes equally poor backgrounds, but where education was highly valued and parents would say, I don't know how you'll ever get to go, but I'm going to give it everything I've got to make sure that you do. Or, I want you to be prepared because a door just might open. I can't see it now, but it might open. And those youngsters would be told that education is the key. And so you want to get the best education that you can. You want to go as far as you can. Well, those students coming from that kind of background, when you look at the much poorer, would certainly be better prepared for opportunities like this. And I think it's just something that, you know, was a societal issue, and people had more limited visions of what their opportunities might be. And so the preparation, the aspiration, would be at a lower level.
And you came from a family with 12 children in it.
That's
and
right.
You had a father and a mother who had those expectations for you, and who passed those expectations on to you.
Yes.
So, yeah.
There was no question that we had the opportunity to get a good education, and it was expected that we would get the best that we could.
And you did.
Yeah.
End of interview for today.